Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for February 17th, 2017. It's a podcast about creativity through music in the voices of the performers you hear each weekend on the radio and online at WCRB. And this is one of my favorite moments from last weekend's live Boston Symphony Orchestra broadcast. It's the waltz from the Symphonie Fantastique by Hector Berlioz. Andras Nelsons led this performance, and you can hear it on demand at our website, classicalwcrb.org. You can also hear Ravel's Le Tombeau de Couperin from that same concert. Unfortunately, the third piece on the program, George Benjamin's Dream of the Song, isn't available on demand because of restrictions imposed by the publisher, but you can hear it next Monday night on our encore broadcast of the BSO at 8 o'clock. Also on demand is last weekend's WCRB in concert with the Boston Chamber Music Society. It's an all-Dvorak program with my colleague Kathy Fuller. Again, that's all at classicalwcrb.org. This weekend, we'll bring you another BSO live concert broadcast at 8 p.m. on Saturday night. Andras Nelsons is back with a program that starts with Gunther Schuller's Seven Studies on Themes of Paul Klee and continues with Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 22 with soloist Emmanuel Ax. And the concert ends with Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. You'll hear from both Andras Nelsons and Emmanuel Ax on this podcast. Also on the podcast is David Hus, who conducts Brahms's German Requiem on WCRB in concert with the Cantata Singers on Sunday at 7 p.m. That program also includes Bach's Cantata No. 60, as well as a really fascinating transcription of Bach's music by Anton Webern. Again, that's on Sunday night at 7 p.m. There are very few guest artists who play with the Boston Symphony as frequently as Emmanuel Ax. He's at Tanglewood every summer, and most symphony hall seasons include a program with him. He knows this orchestra very well. So when I met him at Symphony Hall this week, before talking about the piece he's playing, Mozart's 22nd Piano Concerto, I asked him what he's perceived as the BSO has evolved over the last few years.
Well, evolved is probably the wrong word. It's always been obviously one of the great orchestras of the world. And to me, it's evolved simply by the fact that a lot of the people I grew up with are now not part of the orchestra. I used to be one of the youngest people on stage, and now I'm one of the oldest people. There's still a few from my generation, which is wonderful, but there are lots of young people now, and I think that probably is, you know, as with everything else, it's wonderful to have young people around.
Do you still sense the same identity of the orchestra in the sound, even though there are many younger people now?
Again, for me, that's probably hard to say. I'm not someone who really can identify an orchestra by hearing it. I don't know that that's true anymore. Generally speaking, I think the world has become small. International musical education is the way the world works now. And so you have German violinists studying in New York, Chinese violinists studying in Germany, people who come out of Juilliard or Curtis appointed to be concertmasters or various people in European orchestras. So I think everything's very international. Certainly the Boston Symphony sounds great. I will say that. And of course, in the best of all possible worlds, we identify not with the orchestra as much as with the sound the composer requires.
So let's talk about that, and Mozart specifically. You played this same concerto at Tanglewood, and I just wonder, overall with Mozart, what is it that, it's almost a silly question to ask, because Mozart is so central to every musician's identity, I think, but what is it about Mozart that really compels you, that wakes you up, and that makes you eager?
Well, I think for me, the important thing to realize about Mozart is that he's really a man of the theater. He is, of course, the supreme opera composer, the greatest ever, because his characters are not only full of hit tunes that come up every 5 minutes. Every 5 minutes, it's another hit. But they're complex characters. Not one of them is a cardboard cutout. The way you often find, for example, we once heard Fidelio at the Met, and then went home, and by chance there was a broadcast of Figaro on, you know, which we turned on. And I realized that, of course, Beethoven's music, absolutely top. You know, you can't have better music than Fidelio. But the characters themselves are rather flat and sort of two-dimensional. Whereas with Mozart, the Count, Susanna, Figaro, they all are complicated people, just the way we all are. And that's what makes him extraordinary. And of course, that carries over into instrumental music, and especially the piano concerto, where you always have this, first of all, this idea of, I think he may have been the very first one who really tried to make a difference between the one and the many. So every time you have the piano come in after a tutti, it's a different character. Every piece has a different approach to that. Sometimes, like in the piece we're doing this week, he introduces the piano by something that he never uses again. It's a sort of separate theme that the piano comes in quite nobly, quite brilliantly, melodically, assertively, but we never hear this again. Whereas in the D minor concerto, for example, the piano sneaks in, and that sneak in will be developed later on into many guises. So it's fascinating just to see that relationship. You know, what does the pianist do? How does he relate to the orchestra?
I have heard pianists talk about the operatic qualities of the concertos before, but I never quite pictured it that way. So thank you for that. That's a really great way to look at it. I appreciate that. Just in terms of the playing, pianistically, is Mozart's music something that is more something that grounds you, or is it something that you sort of almost have to aspire to in your playing?
Well, I think it's a combination of first of all, it's just very hard. It's pianistically very difficult. All the runs are, in a way, unpredictable. There's nothing mechanical. So everything is difficult. Everything requires thought. It's simply hard. You have to practice a lot. And another distinguishing feature, I think, for me, of Mozart's piano writing is that all the running notes, not only the melodies, but all the running notes, all the passage work, is actually so melodic and so varied. So if you played all the stuff at a very slow tempo, for example, if you played the Allegro at an adagio pace, it would still make sense because all the lines are so beautifully woven and so beautifully contoured and so melodic. And that's what makes it hard. Because you have to play fast, but not mechanically, ever.
Right. If I can just ask one more question. You talk about the generational change within the BSO, and I know you do some teaching and masterclass work, and I wonder what you hear from people of a younger generation now. There's so much that's different from when you were learning. What do you hear from them in terms of their both musicality and their technique?
First of all, the sheer ability of young people now is beyond belief to me. I'm completely awed by what I hear. They all seem to play everything difficult with great ease. They never play a wrong note. It's just amazing, actually. And so many of them are also highly intelligent and highly committed and original and deeply sensitive and beautiful musicians. I just think it's an amazing time for piano playing. I've never encountered this kind of thing before. I don't really understand it. What I do quite often is I go to YouTube, and I look for our old guys, you know, guys that were even before me, people like Michelangeli, Rubinstein, Horowitz, and it makes me feel good because I will say they also played well.
So, no doubt.
So it's the level now is phenomenal, but we had our heroes, and they still do sound great. So I think piano playing is in great hands these days.
Do you ever listen to yourself when you were younger?
Once in a very great while, yeah. Not so often. And I'm usually surprised by the fact that I could get some notes right and play at a certain tempo, because I was never someone with fabulous technique. But certainly today it's a given, you know. Today people are just remarkable. It's a great time.
Emmanuel Axe, thank you so much for a few minutes of your time today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You'll hear Emmanuel Axe in Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 22 in our live Boston Symphony broadcast tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. And later in this podcast, you'll hear more about that program from Andres Nelsons. First, though, I want to bring you a conversation with conductor David Hoos. My colleague Alan McClellan got together with him to talk about WCRB in concert with the Cantata Singers, and specifically Brahms's German Requiem. That's a piece we usually hear with a huge choir and orchestra, so Alan began by asking David Hoos about the challenge of doing it with a smaller ensemble.
A lot of people were very surprised that Cantata Singers, a chorus of mid-40 in number, would take on this piece that is really associated with choruses of 150, 200. And it does certainly have a grandeur with that many people. But I was hoping that something else would be revealed in a sense of clarity, in a sense of articulation, a sense of phrasing, and a sense of intimacy, a kind of ability for the performers and mostly for the listener to hear into the piece. I think Brahms is often misperceived as a composer who is heavy, but that doesn't seem to me to be really the point. That sound of any sort, thick, thin, light, dark, is not an end in itself, but a consequence of many other factors, mostly having to do with phrasing and having to do with a rhythmic sense and a sense of flexibility. And out of that comes a sense of what the weight in the color is. So we set out to perform the Brahms. Admittedly, we did not do it with 44 singers. We raised the number to 55, but still that number is relatively small. And in fact, there were, as I recall, and there always have been, almost exactly the same number of orchestral musicians on stage as there have been singers. And unsurprisingly to me, from having looked at the piece, it was all very clear. The piece's balances worked quite beautifully. Brahms was so savvy as an orchestrator, and by that I mean also the way he treated the chorus. When he needs the chorus to be heard, with the exception of one place in the piece, he puts the chorus in a most advantageous place. he doesn't imagine that one singer, you know, equals one horn player. It's not that way. And so he finds ways to give the chorus inherent strength that, and as a consequence, you don't need an enormous chorus to sing the piece. And I think with mature singers, as Cantata Singers is blessed to have, and really fine musicians, when the performance is very focused and the singing is at a high level, I think you can come away with a performance that maybe reveals new things, but mostly allows the performers to find new things in it that might or might not be present or might be harder to find in a different kind of performance.
And it has been there for the history of the cantata singers. How many times?
I think this was our third, perhaps our fourth set of performances. Another thing that I think has informed our performances has been that we've never done the Brahms Requiem as the only piece on the program. Often it is, and that's fine. It's a 70-minute piece. It doesn't need anything else. But we've always paired it with other works that I hoped in some way would shed some light on the piece, or maybe the Brahms would shed some light back onto whatever works there were in the first half. One time we did the Brahms with the Schoenberg First Chamber Symphony, Opus 9. Relatively early Schoenberg work, very condensed, kind of virtuosic piece for 13 instruments. One time we did it with a Busoni piece and the Kurt Weill Violin Concerto. In this performance, we paired it with a Bach cantata, Cantata 60, called subtitled Dialogue Between Hope and Fear, and one Webern work, the five movements for string orchestra, and Webern's orchestration of Bach's Ricercari. I thought that first the cantata could shed a lot of light on this very personal work of Brahms, because the Bach not only is a very personal piece for us and for the composer, but it also happens to end with the very famous chorale Es ist genug, which becomes the foundation for the Alban Berg Violin Concerto. So with the Webern works, the very short Webern works, and the Webern-Bach kind of amalgamation, and then this Bach cantata, I thought that those three works together prepared the way in so many different, from different avenues, the way for the Brahms. And it also helps humanize the Brahms. Brahms called it a human requiem, and of course all requia are, but I understand what he means, but sometimes we hear the piece and it's official sounding. It's a little bit distant sounding, I think, and it lacks a certain immediacy. It's very beautiful music. There's no disputing. But I do think that Brahms, almost through his compositional career, did a lot to hide himself emotionally. The music is, by and large, so beautifully crafted and exquisitely orchestrated. And the thought behind the music is kind of perfect. But there is an emotional holding back in, I think, a lot of the music. I think it's true in the symphonies. I think it's certainly true in the Requiem, even in the chamber music.
Even when he's doing these beautiful melodies.
Absolutely.
You would think they're hard on the sleeve melodies, but they're not really. They're kind of reserved.
There is a reserve to them. And the interesting thing is that a lot of people that I've mentioned that idea to argue with me passionately as if I've somehow really missed the point of Brahms, because they find the music so passionate and they connect to the music so passionately. The emotions that Brahms is revealing and inviting us into are universal ones. He's tapped into the kinds of reactions that you and I and hundreds and hundreds, thousands of people have as human beings. But he's not saying, I, Johannes, want to show you me. That's something that Robert Schumann does. And it's so personal, that music is so personal that some people are shut out from it, because it's too personal.
They're almost embarrassed.
And there is something, yes, they can be embarrassed by it, because it is so heart on sleeve and a little bit crazy at times. Brahms is seldom crazy. It's really in the later works, the clarinet quintet, where Brahms, I don't even think intentionally lets himself out, but it, and some of the late piano works show him to be a very depressed person, and you can't help but hear it. But in this very young man's Requiem, that doesn't show. Instead, it has a universality that invites all of us in, embraces us all, gives us a great sense of musical and emotional community. And there is hardly a piece that touches more people and connects with more people than I think does this German Requiem.
You've touched on the question that was in my mind, which is, and it's a maybe impossible to answer question, but the why question. Why did Brahms write this, do you think?
You know, the movement with soprano that comes late in the piece, soprano and chorus, was not actually part of the piece originally. It might have been in his mind. But when the first performance happened, that movement wasn't in it. And he later put the movement in, and it's seen as a memorial to his mother, who had died and to whom he was very close. And some people see the whole Requiem as really relating to his mother, but he generalizes on it. Even if the Brahms Requiem is, in some sense, a memorial to his mother, it still has broad reach, wide arms that really let almost all of us in.
He emphasizes some things, maybe not wanting to include other things. In other words, he emphasizes the comfort aspect.
Yes, and there's very little specific theology in the piece. That is, while the verses are from the Bible, there's not mention of Jesus or Christ, and it's a humanist requiem based on biblical texts. So the biblical verses that Brahms turns to are ones that, in a way, invoke no specific religion or creed, but they are words that really almost anyone, regardless of theological bearing, can relate to.
And I think that disturbed some people in Brahms' time, didn't they? There's something I read about someone who inserted, "I know that my Redeemer liveth," from Messiah.
Oh, just so. Well, that's true. I read that. But you know, they did that all the time. I mean, the people didn't have the kind of reverence for large works that we might have today, and did not necessarily see their compositional entirety as something that really shouldn't be broken. So yeah, they would put arias into the middle of, by other composers, into the middle of Handel oratorios. And it was a little bit hard to imagine what it would have been like, but it was a different mindset.
But he, at the same time, was, I guess his message was not light or frivolous or insignificant as a result of wanting to avoid traditional dogma.
Not at all. I think by avoiding traditional Christian theology, he really enables the piece to, as I say, reach a broad spectrum of people. But the piece is plumbing the depths of despair and optimism and looking beyond. It certainly does not result in anything lighthearted. In fact, very little of Brahms' music is really lighthearted. Even, you know, the scherzos in the symphonies, yeah, they're lively, and they might be heartfelt in some way, but there's not a lot of fun in Brahms. But that's not to say it's not deeply moving and touching and transformative in some really marvelous, kind of inexplicable way.
Joyous is a word.
Well, there is
to my mind.
Certainly a lot of joy in the German Requiem, enormous amounts. And you can forget while you're in the midst of it that this is a Requiem. You think of the Mozart Requiem, and some of it is solemn and some of it is personal and touching, but a lot of it is angry. And there's not even a lot of anger in the Brahms Requiem. There's a resolute sense, a sense of acceptance, a sense of looking to the larger universe, and certainly in the last movement, looking beyond this earth.
He's facing death in it full in the face, you know, it seems to me anyway. It's not a avoidance of the reality of death at all.
Yeah. No, the second movement in particular and other, some of the internal movements certainly have a kind of grimness that, not anger, just grimness, that, and fury sometimes. But in the last movement, there are ways in which the music visits areas, emotional areas, and a musician would say, you know, tonal areas or harmonic areas that are really unseen anywhere else in the entire Requiem. And there are ways in which ideas are become transformed in many of the movements, especially toward the end of the piece, when you have a sense that even though there are thoughts that reach way back to the beginning of the Requiem, that there are thoughts that are now seen in a completely new light and with a kind of luminosity, that the darker colors of the opening movement, movement that has no oboes in it, has no violins in it, you know, just the low strings and the lower woodwinds and the horns and the trombones, things like that, but not a lot of weight in the first movement. But in the last movement, there's a luminosity that, and a transparency, a kind of transparency that the other movements don't have, as if you're looking through to the world beyond.
Yeah, the biblical see through a glass darkly kind of thing, yeah, comes through. Yeah. When you prepare to perform the Brahms Requiem, as you have done it in various times and combined it with other different pieces, I wonder whether, you know, this time when you did it, you somehow thought perhaps Bach could speak to it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But I do believe that for the listener, the Bach and Webern works on the first half of this program did speak to how they heard the Brahms. And it also, they also obviously affected how we heard the Brahms. But I wouldn't say that anything consciously in the first half of the program made me think, oh, that's in Webern's music or Bach's music, and therefore I either see it or need to hunt for it in Brahms's music. I think it's important to respect as much as you can, as is humanly possible, the efficacy of each composer's works and let them play off of each other. I remember one time when we performed the Fauré Requiem, and the first half of the concert was a performance of a late Stravinsky piece, Thraini, tough nut to crack, and a fantastic piece. Never had been performed in Boston. Can you imagine a big Stravinsky piece, its first performance in this city? And I was much younger. I had the sense that when it was over with, that poor Fauré Requiem suffered, not in comparison, but the performance of the Fauré probably suffered because there's a coldness to Stravinsky's music that is so captivating and infectious that it probably just spilled over into this Fauré Requiem performance, which probably was hard as nails, which is not something that the Fauré Requiem should be. They are polar opposites in a certain way, and just feeling the friction between them would be very intriguing. But I don't think you should, I don't think it makes sense to consciously try to let one composer affect the other. They do in our head.
Perhaps the reserve that Brahms felt that you were describing is somewhat affected by his understanding of Bach and what Bach did.
Well, certainly. Brahms was a fine conductor himself, and he edited, you know, he was one of the editors of the first Bach Gesellschaft, and he knew those cantatas. There's no doubt in my mind that the lofty integrity and imagination that Bach's music offers us affected Brahms's own writing, as did other composers like Heinrich Schütz, whose music he programmed quite a lot himself. And in a certain way, Brahms's music, to my ear, is closer to Schütz's music than Bach's music. I mean, a composer 100 years older than Bach. And certainly, when people do pair works with the Brahms Requiem, I sometimes see big works of Schütz, like the Musikalische Exequien, as the first half. And that makes a good deal of sense to me.
Seems intense to me.
Well, it is very intense because the Schütz is very dense and compact. But the Brahms has a kind of spaciousness and calm, even in the most sort of hysterical places.
Right.
There has a grandeur. And maybe if you hear those two pieces back to back, the way you hear the two pieces they're informed. Your memory of the Schütz, if that were, say, on the first half, and the way you're taking in the Brahms at this time.
This is all fantastic, and I appreciate your time here to do this. It's a delight, and looking forward to the broadcast of Brahms.
Thank you very much.
David Hus really is one of the most thoughtful programmers out there, and I think you'll have that sense when you hear the cantata singers on Sunday. Alan McCullen brings them to you on WCRB in Concert Sunday night at 7 p.m. Let's go back to the BSO concert that's on the air tomorrow at 8 o'clock. It's a program that begins with Gunther Schuller's seven studies on themes of Paul Klee. The model of that piece is really the same as Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, a set of movements each inspired by a piece of visual art. So when I met Andres Nelsons at Symphony Hall, I asked him whether his preparation included studying the actual artwork or if he prepared the piece by studying the music alone.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think Gunther Schuller is one of the, I think, greatest American composers. I'm so happy I had the opportunity to know him and to conduct and also now conducting again his music. And it's very difficult to answer correctly because I don't know whether this is the right answer, because from one hand, of course, when you study the piece, and of course you research as much as you can, and of course in the case of Pictures Exhibition, of course in this case with Mr. Schuller and Mr. Klee, of course you want to know. Because, and you should know, I think, as well, if you are a performer, and then you analyze and you see how that reflects to the music, and but somehow after you've done that, and you think, I wish I would not know, and I would just, you know, where would my fantasy lead me to, you know?
Because, I get that. Sure.
But
I can understand.
It's
that.
A very, you know, I can't say or admit that or in like it's the right way to do, because it's.
Don't mean to put you on the spot.
You know, because of course when you study something you should study. It can't be your first. I mean, you can't be the pilot for the first time with the people in your very first flight. You know, so you. So you know what yeah. I mean, but there is some kind of. But of course, that's at the end. Of course, there is also very it's very interesting. There is a kind of mystical feeling, and also, which kind of confirms that the two art forms. I mean, are of course from one hand they are joined, but from the other hand they are also very different, and it works. And to different gives different associations. When you go to the art gallery and see a piece of art, every person has a different feeling of brown color. You know, that's somebody might say very uncomfortable. Somebody might see it very rich, very you know. And I think the same is with this music. When you hear it goes to your heart and to your intellect. I think, like Wagner told, it's the highest art of music. I would say highest art. The music is the highest art because it goes beyond the intellect. It goes you can understand, but actually there are things you can't understand and can't explain because you feel them somewhere. And so therefore, I think still that there, even if you know what the original is. The music, when you hear the music, it has its own space and its own universe where you actually can always hear each time seeing other things. And I think this is something great. And in order to do so, actually, you need to see more and more times to start seeing different things. I don't advise that it sounds like you're taking medicine or then you take more, then you see more more side effects, but really I think because
no, that makes sense. It makes sense to sort of maybe engage with the artwork at some point, but then set it aside. Yeah. Let it set aside, and then allow your own mind to take over in the music.
During your life, again, you want to come back, and sometimes it's very interesting to come back to the even let's say even if it's an opera or if it's a literal source. You know, you always when you want to come back to read it, and then you say, oh yes, and then you go back again in. So it's a long process, I think, of an individual process of everyone. But I think it's absolutely one of the strongest pieces, and obviously it's a very early piece, but so challenging and so you know novatoric, and the way of his instrumentation and using the instruments and making fun with them as well, you know, and he. You know, well, you can feel his character already from
sure. And I guess now that you're talking about it that way, I mean, it is an earlier piece, which means that it's been around for a while. It's not really new music anymore. Mm-hmm. And in a way, there are sounds within that piece that are totally of their time. It's a little bit of a time capsule. And it's so now that you're speaking about it that way, I like how it is on the same program with the Eroica, which is also completely of its time. You know, it's relevant today, of course. Yeah. I mean, the Eroica is never not relevant, but the language is so specific to its time. You know, it was revolutionary, but it would have never happened any other time than right then.
Yeah.
Is there any particular reason for choosing the Eroica right now? I mean, you've conducted all the Beethoven symphonies many times, but what is it about the Eroica right now that made it the choice for this particular time?
Well, I think, I mean, Gunther, I mean, if, Mr. Schuller, I've heard him so talking of so many exciting things, and I could have learned from many, all of us could learn so many things, and he was a funny, modest, sometimes sometimes tough and direct he could insult, but in the meantime he could just grab you and say, oh, you know, so all the personality, and I think that's all in his music as well, and all the protest or reaction to anything. I think he would challenge things, and I think. And he did challenge, and Beethoven. He was, I think, obviously we never met him, but he also liked to challenge things. Of course, he was not okay with if he was not feeling okay, he would not agree. He was like, no, boom. Either he's these two chords of heroic, either these are, he's saying, stop, I'm, it's enough, I don't hear, it's God, stop, I want to leave the, I want to compose a symphony about the hero, but you don't let me because I don't hear, boom, boom, you know, it's almost, what, it's difficult to say what he meant, but it's a revolution. I think it's in Gunther's, it's, there is also a lot of revolution within, although he's not making a revolution, I mean, in the composition techniques, you know, he's very much influenced by the second Vienna school, and you can, but it's very, you're also unique and you're very much Gunther. You can hear, you know.
There's the word idiosyncratic. It's just him. It's nobody else's own language. Yeah.
And of course, in Beethoven, absolutely. And of course, Gunther's compositions will be, people will play 50 years from now and 100 years from now, and there is this kind of interesting feeling. I mean, it's sometimes very difficult to explain, and because it's very sensitive. Because sometimes you hear a new piece, and sometimes you hear, okay, so this is an interesting piece, and you feel you need to perform it more because you need to understand more. And sometimes you feel, yes, this piece, this piece will live. And sometimes you feel very sorry and somehow guilty in a way. You think, oh, I'm not sure whether if this piece at this, and then these things goes change these feelings. But this is somehow this so-called obviously intuition, which says you. And I think with Gunther, it's always you hear, you think, yes, this will be performed.
That's Andres Nelsons, and you can hear him lead the Boston Symphony Orchestra live on the radio tomorrow night beginning at 8 p.m. For more details, visit classicalwcrb.org. Well, this week brought some great news concerning the BSO. For the second year in a row, they won the Grammy Award for Best Orchestral Performance of 2016. I'm not sure it's unprecedented, but it has to be rare that a single orchestra wins consecutive Grammys, especially when the two wins were part of the same ongoing project. In this case, Under Stalin's Shadow, the series of Shostakovich symphonies Andras and the BSO is recording over the next several years. I had the chance to talk about it with Mark Volpe, the managing director of the BSO, and Tony Fogg, the orchestra's artistic administrator. Here's our conversation.
Mark, you told me months ago that this release was going to be even better than the first release, and I didn't disbelieve you, but were you surprised, just given sort of how the Grammys work for twice in a row now?
Well, I was certain we were going to win the engineering award and not win because we won last year, but obviously I got it backwards, as great as engineering, of course, was.
Right.
But I think it's just a external validation of the work that Andres is doing with the Boston Symphony, and our partners at Deutsche Grammophon have certainly embraced it, and now we're, you know, continuing the cycle, and so it's you know, compelling music played in the most persuasive way, and Andres certainly has he was in New York with his wife, who's at the Met at the moment, and he was like a little boy. He was so excited. He was prepared not to win. You know? I was just going to text him, or Bernadette, or press person, was going to text him if we didn't win. So he's excited, and it's nice to see the orchestra. You know, it's a nice feeling. I mean, and it just affirms that there's still a role for recording, and your station's part of that, and. It's great to have that.
We do what we can. Tony, you know, I have to tell you that my impression of this volume two, I love the fifth. The eighth is great. The ninth, which is one that I didn't even know as well as the others, that's the one that really jumps out to me on that collection, because there's a quality to it that Andres actually explained to me. There's this sort of mania that has to take hold.
It's manic.
And that's really hard to pull off, because you can either get loud or you can get fast, and it still wouldn't have what's going on. So what do you see?
Well, it's a very elusive piece, and you know, we hadn't played it since the 1960s, so it was a real discovery for all of our players on every level. It was a discovery technically, because it's quite unlike the other symphonies in the technical demands. You know, the fifth and the eighth have huge demands of stamina on the players and sustaining tone, where this needs a sort of quicksilver approach. But it's it's a sort of the anti-Ninth Symphony. It's everything, you know, when you say Ninth, you think of Beethoven or Mahler or Schubert or Bruckner or whatever. You know, you think of these sort of summation pieces, and this is not at all. It was a real, jab at the system of the time and of the authorities to write a sort of farcical Ninth Symphony. But it's a very compact piece and mercurial in its moods, and so it was a great discovery for me too. I knew the piece somewhat, but not in the sort of detail that I did after the course of sitting through hours and hours of editing. But it was I think a real revelation for everyone.
Yeah,
it's always fun to see the orchestra play a piece that obviously a composer very much in their repertoire, Shostakovich, that they were not familiar with. And there might have been one person. I don't even know. I didn't check the demographics. And there might have been one or two of the old Russian musicians who played in Soviet orchestras back when there was a Soviet Union. But it's always intriguing to see how they played quite a bit of Shostakovich, but this was fun experience.
Yeah, this was different. And
I loved what Tony was saying. It's so true. I mean, because it's Ninth Symphony, and he basically said, yeah, I got 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. So he took a very different, consciously, obviously, a little thumbing at that, some of the, other, more profound statements on summation pieces.
That's Mark Volpe and Tony Fogg from the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And you'll hear more from both of them next week on The Answered Question. You can find the latest TAQ at our website, classicalwcrb.org, and you can subscribe to this podcast at iTunes or through your favorite podcast app. And look for TAQ on WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud pages. Thank you to all of the guests on this podcast, including Emmanuel Axe, David Hoos, Andres Nelsons, Mark Volpe, and Tony Fogg. Thanks also to the staffs of the Cantata Singers and the Boston Symphony Orchestra for making these conversations possible. And thanks as well to Alan McClellan here at WCRB. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.